In the tumultuous decade of 1933 to 1943, four extraordinary women philosophers crafted revolutionary ideas that would reshape modern thought: Hannah Arendt, Simone de Beauvoir, Ayn Rand, and Simone Weil, each confronting exile, war, and totalitarianism, developed radically different philosophical responses to the same fundamental question: what gives human life meaning and dignity in a world that seems determined to crush both? Their answers would inspire movements ranging from existentialism to objectivism, from feminism to mystical Christianity. The Visionaries has become a cultural touchstone for intellectuals seeking to understand how philosophy emerges from lived experience. Michelle Obama has cited it as a powerful reminder that great thinking often comes from those pushed to society's margins, while the book's exploration of how ideas are forged in crisis has made it required reading in philosophy departments worldwide. These four women, writing from hotel rooms, prison camps, and factory floors, weren't merely commenting on their catastrophic era. They were actively creating the intellectual frameworks through which we still understand freedom, identity, and human dignity today. In May 1943, four extraordinary women found themselves at pivotal moments in their intellectual journeys, each poised to transform philosophy in her own way. In a Paris café, Simone de Beauvoir contemplated the tension between finite existence and infinite possibility, crafting an essay on existentialism that would lay groundwork for her revolutionary feminist philosophy. Despite the hardships of Nazi occupation, food shortages, censorship, German soldiers patrolling the streets, she felt remarkably free and certain in her intellectual pursuits. Across the English Channel, Simone Weil lay in a hospital bed, her body wasting away from tuberculosis and self-imposed starvation, yet producing some of the most penetrating spiritual writings of the century. Having abandoned her privileged intellectual position to work in factories and fight in the Spanish Civil War, Weil had experienced a profound religious transformation. Now, working for the Free French government in London, she poured her unique mind onto the page hour after hour, day after day, neglecting both sleep and nourishment while writing a 300-page manuscript diagnosing Europe's spiritual malady. In New York, Ayn Rand fumed over her publisher's failure to properly market her philosophical novel, The Fountainhead, where others saw an unmarketable 700-page philosophical manifesto disguised as fiction. Rand envisioned a transformative literary experience that would lead readers from darkness into light. With characteristic certainty, she expected minimum sales of 100,000 copies and a Hollywood adaptation starring Gary Cooper, predictions that would prove remarkably prescient. Meanwhile, Hannah Arendt struggled with profound isolation in her Manhattan apartment, writing in January 1943, "We lost our home, we lost our occupation, we lost our language, we left our relatives in the Polish ghettos, and our best friends have been killed in concentration camps." 10 years after fleeing Hitler's Germany, the 36-year-old philosopher felt emptiness and dislocation, experiencing what Weil described as the inevitable consequence of existential uprooting. These four women, a French existentialist, a Jewish mystic, a Russian-American individualist, and a German-Jewish political theorist, approached the catastrophe of their time from radically different perspectives, yet each was engaged in the same fundamental task: redefining what it means to be human in the face of totalitarianism, exile, and war. Their philosophical responses to this challenge would shape intellectual life for generations to come. By 1933, the rise of Nazism had made Germany uninhabitable for independent thinkers. For Hannah Arendt, the turning point came in May, when she and her mother were unexpectedly arrested by the Gestapo during breakfast near Berlin's Alexanderplatz. Though they were released the same day, Arendt made her decision. There was no future in this country, at least not for people like her. That summer, Arendt's research on Rahel Varnhagen, a 19th-century German-Jewish intellectual, proved eerily relevant to her own situation. Her psychological portrait revealed a woman whose denial of Jewish origins made it impossible to construct a stable identity. Once one has negated oneself, however, there are no longer any particular choices. There is only one aim, always and at any given moment, to be different from what one is. This insight would inform Arendt's lifelong exploration of identity, exile, and the tension between assimilation and authenticity. Mother and daughter escaped through what Arendt called the classic route, crossing the Ore Mountains via the Green Border into Czechoslovakia through a sympathizer's house with a front door in Germany and a back door in Czechoslovakia. By summer 1933, about 40,000 had fled Germany, with 20,000 reaching Paris, where Arendt would eventually settle. Simone Weil had also bid farewell to Germany that summer after witnessing firsthand the nation's collapse. Engineers renting chairs in public gardens, elderly men in bowler hats begging at subway exits, students selling matches on streets. With nearly half the German working class idle, the political left remained hopelessly divided against the rising Nazi threat. By autumn 1932, Weil had lost all respect for the Communist Party, and a year later, her prediction proved correct: Hitler victorious and purges underway. The politically committed Red Simone fully embraced her revolutionary educator role, fighting tirelessly against ignorance and oppression. Wrapped in a red flag, she led protest marches, singing the Internationale at full volume. Yet behind this fierce revolutionary persona was another Simone, fragile, ascetic, plagued by debilitating headaches, who donated most of her salary to refugees while keeping only what unemployed workers received on state support. Meanwhile, Ayn Rand faced her own struggles in America. By spring 1934, the Great Depression had depleted her finances, despite her Hollywood chateau-inspired home's impressive facade. Her husband, Frank O'Connor's acting career had stalled, and Rand's own literary ambitions remained unfulfilled. She approached her work with fierce determination, writing in her 1929 diary, "You are only a writing engine, all will and all control." Drawing inspiration from Russian literary giants like Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, she sought to create metaphysical blockbusters for the 20th century. Her screenplay, Red Pawn, had attracted studio interest but remained unfilmed, while her novel, We the Living, faced rejection from New York publishers during Roosevelt's New Deal era when collectivist solutions to the Depression were gaining popularity. Rand saw these rejections as evidence that East Coast elites had been infiltrated by communists, lamenting through her character Kira, "It was me against 150 million. In early 1933, Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre experienced a philosophical revelation that would transform their thinking. At the Bec de Gaz bar in Paris, their former classmate Raymond Aron introduced them to phenomenology. "You see, my dear fellow, if you are a phenomenologist, you can talk about this cocktail and make philosophy out of it." Sartre turned pale with emotion. Here was what he'd sought for years, a way to describe objects just as he saw and touched them and extract philosophy from the process. Phenomenology offered them a third way beyond idealism and realism, affirming both the supremacy of conscience and the reality of the visible world. Through Edmund Husserl's works, they discovered his principle of back to things themselves, describing what appears to consciousness without distortion or prejudice. Husserl's key insight was that consciousness is always consciousness of something, what he called intentionality. Whether tasting liqueur, being disturbed by noise, remembering Spain, or hoping for good weather, consciousness is directed towards something beyond itself. While Beauvoir and Sartre were discovering phenomenology, Weil was undergoing her own intellectual transformation. By early 1934, Paris erupted in violence following the Stavisky scandal, a massive banking fraud scheme that had embezzled hundreds of millions in public funds. The day after serious street riots left numerous dead and thousands wounded, Prime Minister Edouard Daladier resigned after just 6 days in office. In the aftermath, Weil wrote to her friend Simone Petrament that she had decided to withdraw entirely from any kind of political activity, except for theoretical work, believing that all the blood that will be shed in vain. At 25, she devoted herself to writing what she called her intellectual will and testament, an essay prophetically titled Reflections Concerning the Causes of Liberty and Social Oppression. When millions joined the general strike on February 12, 1934, Beauvoir remained aloof, such a stranger to all practical political activities that joining never occurred to her. Despite her unique relationship with Sartre, she hadn't found her position in life, professionally, literarily, politically, philosophically, or even erotically. A new self was fermenting inside her, not yet emerged. Among women her age, some seemed far more advanced, particularly Weil, whose intelligence, asceticism, total commitment, and sheer courage filled Beauvoir with admiration. Their first meeting sparked immediate conflict. When Beauvoir learned Weil had wept over famine in China, she envied her, having a heart that could beat right across the world. But when Weil declared revolution to feed the starving was all that mattered, Beauvoir countered that finding meaning in existence was more important. Weil's cutting response, "It's easy to see you've never been hungry," ended their relationship instantly. This philosophical tension between Beauvoir's focus on individual meaning and Weil's emphasis on collective suffering would define their divergent paths throughout the decade. Meanwhile, Rand was developing her own philosophical voice through her diary entries, addressing fundamental questions about free will, emotion versus reason, language, unconditional values, and the tension between egoism and altruism. Her opening entries revealed both ambition and conviction. These are the vague beginnings of an amateur philosopher, to be checked with what I learn when I have mastered philosophy. By late 1934, Ayn Rand's first American publication, the courtroom drama Woman on Trial, premiered at Los Angeles's Hollywood Playhouse. The play featured an innovative twist. 12 audience volunteers served as jury, delivering a real verdict before the drama's conclusion. Beyond the surface murder mystery lay Rand's true experiment, testing the audience's sense of life, their fundamental values and worldview through their judgment of the passionate, independent protagonist versus conventional morality. Though critics praised the play and its jury gimmick, Rand was disappointed they missed what she considered its true subject, the struggle between heroic individuals and the far too many. The play centered on Secretary Karen Andre, accused of murdering her boss and lover, Bjorn Faulkner, after his fatal fall from a luxury penthouse. With contradictory testimony and inconclusive evidence, the jury's verdict would reveal their fundamental values, whether they sided with passionate self-assertiveness or conventionality, independence versus conformity. Meanwhile, Simone Weil was conducting a different kind of experiment. Believing nothing could be politically saved, but determined to test her insights through direct experience, she took an unskilled job at a Paris metal factory in December 1934. She sought to bridge the ignorance between social classes that generated monstrous worlds based on false assumptions, noting that neither Marx, Engels, Trotsky, nor Stalin had ever experienced factory life firsthand. Weil's factory experiment revealed the crushing reality of industrial labor. Her diary documented dizzying speeds, constant fatigue, and an overwhelming feeling of slavery. Throughout her six-month experiment, she never once achieved production quotas, regularly producing rejects as machines refused to obey her will. The monotony led to accident-prone absent-mindedness and a kind of inner death that extended to her entire existence. Fear of failure invaded her dreams. Crying fits became her only relief, yet even these couldn't alleviate her murderous headaches. This experience crystallized her philosophical critique of Marxism. She questioned whether any human could maintain dignity under such conditions, challenging Marx's pseudo-religious philosophy of history. Her reflections attacked Marxism's central assumption that progress in productive forces inevitably leads to liberation. Weil argued that both capitalism and communism shared a dangerous fetish for growth, dreaming of economic victory and liberation from work itself. In autumn 1934, a charged drama unfolded in Rouen, France, centered around Beauvoir, Sartre, and an 18-year-old former pupil named Olga Kosakovich. This romantic triangle embodied philosophical tensions between freedom and necessity, authenticity and inauthenticity. Olga had caught Beauvoir's attention with a brilliant essay on Kant, displaying an unpredictable willfulness that oscillated between clear-sightedness and profound disorientation. Unlike Beauvoir, who consciously fought for emancipation from her parents' demands, Olga simply threw herself into life without plans. She valued only her emotions, denied the future altogether, and lived entirely in the present. To the philosophically minded Sartre and Beauvoir, she embodied the utopia of philosophical immediacy, the principle of pure vitality surrendering to the moment. Their contrasting perspectives on provincial life became evident. While Sartre's sought teaching as an unworthy cul-de-sac where his freedom was trickling away, Beauvoir viewed her profession as a path to genuine self-determination in an era when French women couldn't even vote. By 1936, Europe's descent toward war accelerated. Hitler placed German industry on war footing and invaded the demilitarized Rhineland without consequences. With Germany's left opposition crushed, the regime intensified anti-Jewish propaganda. Mussolini proclaimed an Italian imperium after conquering Ethiopia, while Stalin executed opponents in Moscow show trials. The year saw the rise of leftist popular fronts in Spain and France, but in Spain, this fragile coalition victory led to Franco's military uprising in July, sparking a brutal civil war. Against this backdrop, the four philosophers grappled with questions of love, freedom, and commitment. Hannah Arendt found herself drawn to Heinrich Blücher, a Berlin-born autodidact living illegally in Paris. A former communist who had grown increasingly disillusioned with party ideology, Blücher's intellectual independence matched his poverty, making him a pariah par excellence and entirely to Arendt's taste. Though they were drawn to each other, Arendt remained cautious about preserving her identity within love, a concern central to her doctoral thesis on Augustine. In her dissertation, Arendt examined the relevance of the other for one's relationship with oneself and the world. She found that Augustine's Christian philosophy surprisingly diminished the individual other's importance, as true love was directed toward God. For Augustine, we love our neighbors not for their uniqueness, but for their equality in God's creation and shared sinful nature. This theological framework offered no space for preserving individuality in love, a scandal in Western thought that Arendt had identified in 1928. By 1936, Arendt recognized how Augustine's theological devaluation of the individual had found secular expression in totalitarianism, where the almighty Führer replaced God and national origin myths substituted for religious narratives. For Arendt, private love relationships became outposts of resistance against total conformity. Her relationship with Blücher offered a revolutionary discovery that she could achieve both the love of my life and a oneness with myself. Meanwhile, Beauvoir and Sartre lived a hotel room existence in Paris, though theirs was a freely chosen nonconformism rather than exile's necessity. As tenured lycée teachers, they made cafes in Montparnasse and the Latin Quarter their studies and sitting rooms. By November, Olga had followed them to Paris without her parents' permission, living a floor above Beauvoir and working irregularly in a tea room, joining them for nightlife as a duo or trio. What troubled Beauvoir most about her life was Olga's permanent challenge to her bond with Sartre. This wasn't about sexual jealousy, but about the very nature of their relationship. Sartre's numerous sexual trysts consumed his Paris time, leaving him barely able to meet Beauvoir for coffee or to exchange manuscript pages. Olga represented the fundamental question: was Beauvoir's bond with Sartre truly the necessary relationship they claimed? The struggle wasn't for erotic primacy, but concerned the very nature of freedom in loving relationships, whether constancy represented liberation or restriction. In August 1936, Simone Weil joined Republican forces in the Spanish Civil War despite her physical frailty. Her six-week adventure included bombing raids, deadly combat fears, and moral dilemmas like witnessing the planned execution of a Catholic priest. Though physically unsuited for combat, her extreme short-sightedness made her comrades unanimously vote against issuing her a rifle. Whale insisted on serving. Her participation ended when she stepped into a pot of boiling oil, causing severe burns on her left leg that likely saved her life, as most of her unit was later executed after an enemy attack. Whale's Spanish experience deepened her philosophical critique of violence. She observed that such slaughter required a fundamental blockage of the human imagination about who belonged to humanity. Once a certain class of people has been placed by the temporal and spiritual authorities outside the ranks of those whose life has value, then nothing comes more naturally to men than murder. Civil wars particularly accelerated this dehumanization, as former neighbors became enemies, making reconciliation seem impossible. Her linguistic criticism examined how empty rhetoric fueled conflict. She argued that history's cruelest wars lacked definable goals, and that this absence of purpose intensified their cruelty. Using the Trojan War as an example of bloodshed over a chimera, she demonstrated how terms like nation, capitalism, and communism became empty vessels swollen with blood and tears. For Whale, this emptiness of language made violence boundless, as words divorced from reality enabled escalating brutality. By late 1938, Whale's health had deteriorated so severely that teaching became impossible. Her persistent headaches mirrored the worsening political situation, leading her to contemplate suicide as she feared for her rational mind. Unable to work intellectually due to her physical suffering, she sought relief through sacred music. During a visit to the Benedictine Abbey of Solems, renowned for its Gregorian chant, she attended every service despite intense headaches, where each sound was as painful as a blow. Through extreme concentration, she found a pure and perfect joy in the ineffable beauty of the song and words, an experience that helped her understand the possibility of loving divine love through misfortune. The transformative moment came when reciting George Herbert's poem Love during a period of intense headaches. Whale experienced something profound. She felt herself entirely imbued with divine love in the form of Christ's immediate presence. This mystical experience convinced her she had encountered a presence more real than that of a human being, revealing a realm of transcendence beyond human language and knowledge. Meanwhile, Ayn Rand was developing her own philosophical vision. By February 1936, she had fully conceptualized her ideal hero, Howard Roark, an architect embodying her philosophy of radical individualism. Roark possesses his own superiority and the utter worthlessness of the world as innate qualities. His complete selfishness is as natural to him as breathing. Unlike most humans who develop through social interaction, Roark begins at the summit of autonomy, viewing others with indifference and an infinite, calm contempt. Struggling to develop the plot for her novel about Howard Roark, Rand took a secretarial job at L.I. Jacques Kahn's architectural firm specializing in skyscrapers. In March 1938, when she asked Kahn what commissions presented the greatest challenge, his answer, housing, triggered her breakthrough moment. During her lunch break, Rand crafted the novel's climactic plot. Roark would destroy a public housing project built from his own designs after a committee imposed planning changes that compromised his vision. When France fell to Nazi Germany in June 1940, the four philosophers faced their darkest hour. Simone de Beauvoir faced her first nervous breakdown after learning of the Wehrmacht's imminent invasion. She packed only necessities, including her decade of correspondence with Sartre, and joined what French people still call the Exodus, a mass flight of over 3 million Parisians. When Marshal Pétain signed the armistice on June 22nd, Beauvoir felt like a character in some futuristic novel where time had gone haywire. Hannah Arendt had escaped the chaos following France's capitulation, fleeing from the women's camp at Gers near the Pyrenees with only her toothbrush. She walked for days toward Lourdes, where she encountered Walter Benjamin, who had just fled Paris. Benji and I played chess from morning to evening, and between games we read newspapers. Everything was as fine as could be until the ceasefire terms were published, along with the infamous extradition clause. This treaty obligated France to hand former German citizens over to the Nazis upon demand. As suicides became increasingly common among refugees, Arendt developed her understanding of the Nazi program's true horror, not merely the persecution of individuals or even Jews as a whole, but the systematic preparation of living corpses. Their goal was the extinction of all spontaneity, turning every individual human being into a thing that would always behave the same way under identical conditions. During the phony war of late 1939, Simone Veil lived in her parents' Paris apartment, where her chronic pain was partially relieved by a cocaine rinse treatment for sinusitis. While waiting for violence to erupt, she produced The Iliad, or The Poem of Force, a profound philosophical meditation on war's nature. Veil's essay identifies how violence turns humans into objects, first by killing them, but more insidiously by transforming living people into things with souls. This objectification creates a state akin to slavery, where life becomes death strung out over a whole lifetime. For Veil, the philosophical imperative, know thyself, was especially crucial during wartime. She saw the Iliad's healing value in showing that force destroys both victims and perpetrators. Force is as pitiless to the man who possesses it as it is to its victims. The poem reveals that no one truly controls force. Even conquerors must eventually bow to it. To combat emptiness and fear after France's fall, Beauvoir imposed strict routines upon herself. From July 6th, she spent afternoons studying Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit at the Bibliothèque Nationale. She found comfort in this perspective. Just as at the age of 20, my heart bleeding because of my cousin Jacques, I read Homer to set all humanity between my private grief, so now I endeavored to sink this present experience of mine in the trend of world development. Though tempted by Hegel's system that made individuals ants in an anthill, she maintained inner resistance to it. A year after Paris fell, Beauvoir experienced a profound transformation. Rigidity gave way to resolve, depression to an active will, and fear to contentment. She accepted that life wasn't a story of my own telling, but a compromise between myself and the world. Sartre's return from the POW camp contributed to her changed mood, though his strict moral standards initially unsettled her. In January 1941, Beauvoir experienced a philosophical breakthrough, creating a new philosophy of freedom based on mutual existential recognition. Rather than seeing relationships as battles of master and slave, she declared freedom could only be won by each together. Her diary reveals this transformation. Human reality is nothing other than what it makes itself be. She rejected all invisible guiding hands, whether Hegelian, Marxist, or religious, declaring the acting human being as the true creator and sole standard. When Sartre returned to Paris in spring 1941, philosophical divergences emerged between the couple. While Sartre worked on his magnum opus, Being and Nothingness, which would ultimately contain just 5 pages on ethics with a content-free nihilism contradicting Beauvoir's position, she carefully managed their intellectual relationship. For Beauvoir, this period marked creative freedom as she began work on her second novel, exploring social and political factors in the struggle between self and other. Meanwhile, Veil found unexpected peace at a farm in Saint-Marcel d'Ardèche, describing her dilapidated wooden hut as filled with sensual pleasures, despite locals' confusion about her identity. Having been hired as a harvest worker through Catholic friends, Veil embraced manual labor, writing that the government could not do me a greater good than forbidding me from being active in the intellectual professions. Forced to return to Marseille, where her parents had waited over a year hoping for passage to America, Veil became consumed with questions about baptism. When would it be suitable to take this holiest sacrament? Would voluntary submission be genuine or sacrilegious? Could salvation exist outside the Catholic Church? In this winter of waiting and turmoil, Vale experienced her most productive period, delivering lectures on Greek philosophy in the Dominican crypt and filling notebooks with explorations of fundamental questions: the self's value and origin, its relationship with God and others, the nature of love and goodness, and the tension between finitude and transcendence. Vale's notebooks reveal an uncanny resonance with Beauvoir's contemporaneous writings, though with profoundly different conclusions. Where both began with human mortality and finitude, Vale criticized existentialism for taking the wrong path at the first philosophical step, preserving and rebelling through the self rather than embracing the purifying decreation of the self. We possess nothing in this world except the power to say, I. It is that which has to be offered up to God, that is to say, destroyed. By 1943, the four philosophers had crystallized their visions of human freedom and dignity. Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead, was finally published, its protagonist, Howard Roark, standing trial for dynamiting a housing project built from his compromised designs. In his defense speech, Roark declares, "I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life. The integrity of a man's creative work is of greater importance than any charitable endeavor." The jury's verdict? Not guilty. Simone de Beauvoir had been suspended from teaching after allegations of corrupting a minor, allowing her to officially call herself what she'd always wanted to be, a freelance writer and philosopher. By late August, Gallimard had published her first novel, and she quickly wrote a 100-page essay titled Pyrrhus and Cineas for Gallimard, arguing that one must desire and promote others' freedom for the sake of one's own intentions. She described creative work as transcendence, neither for others nor for an already existing self, but as a process of self-renewal that goes beyond previous limits. Hannah Arendt awaited the war's end in New York with growing impatience, focusing on her research program to expose the factors behind totalitarianism, anti-Semitism, imperialism, and the logic of dehumanization. Despite her isolation from both Zionist groups and German exile intellectuals, she maintained her independence of thought, becoming very much her own woman. Simone Weil had been hospitalized at Middlesex Hospital for 4 months, her condition steadily worsening. She refused to eat properly, claiming solidarity with starving people in France, especially children. By June, she was so weak, a French military chaplain was called, but she refused to speak with him or be baptized. Despite her high fever, Weil arrived at the Ashford Sanatorium in good spirits and fully conscious. Looking out at the trees and fields, she called it a beautiful room to die in. When Dr. Broderith asked about her profession, she answered with a smile that she was a philosopher and interested in humanity. These four visionaries, Hannah Arendt, Simone de Beauvoir, Ayn Rand, and Simone Weil, each responded to the catastrophe of their time by developing philosophical frameworks that continue to shape our understanding of freedom, identity, and human dignity. Their divergent paths, from Weil's mystical Christianity to Rand's radical individualism, from Beauvoir's existential feminism to Arendt's political theory, offer complementary perspectives on the fundamental question: what makes human life meaningful in the face of overwhelming forces that threaten to crush the individual spirit? Their answers, forged in the crucible of exile, war, and totalitarianism, remain vital resources for navigating our own uncertain times. As we face contemporary challenges to human dignity and freedom, these four remarkable women remind us that philosophy is not merely an academic exercise, but a necessary response to the most pressing questions of human existence.